Today is Monday, March 30th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. The United States is extending its social distancing until the end of April.
I'm prepared to do whatever is necessary to, number one, save lives, and number two, bring our economy back strong just like it was before.
Plus, the effect of India's lockdown on the poor.
People with young children are wondering where to get food. People with, older people haven't got enough supplies.
And why scheduling is key to remote working. Those stories and more are next. The U.S. state of New York has passed a somber milestone of 1,000 coronavirus deaths, while governments across the world instituted or extended new lockdowns to try to blunt the effects of the outbreak. U.S. President Donald Trump announced that U.S. guidelines on social distancing to prevent the virus spread would be extended to the end of April. They had originally been scheduled to end on Monday.
I'm prepared to do whatever is necessary to, number one, save lives, and number two, bring our economy back strong just like it was before.
The reversal by Trump, which he said would be disclosed in greater detail on Tuesday, came as the U.S. death toll topped 2,460 from the respiratory disease, according to a Reuters tally. A Johns Hopkins University aggregate estimates that the total number of COVID-19 cases in the United States tops 143,000, the most of any country in the world. The total number of cases globally is over 724,000. On Sunday, while speaking to U.S. cable news broadcaster CNN, Dr. Anthony Fauci said the United States could experience more than 100,000 deaths from COVID-19. The director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases explained the difficulty in creating models predicting these outcomes.
We feel that the mitigation that we're doing right now is having an effect. It's very difficult to quantitate it because you have two dynamic things going on at the same time. You have the virus going up and you have the mitigation trying to push it down. But the decision to prolong, not prolong, but to extend this mitigation process until the end of April, I think was a wise and prudent decision.
Among the new restrictions going into effect around the world on Monday are isolation orders in Moscow, where people are only allowed to leave their homes for essential jobs, shopping for food or medicine, and for medical emergencies. Nigerian President Muhammadu Buhari announced stay-at-home orders for the country's capital, Abuja, and its largest city of Lagos, and said that travel to and from other parts of the country should be avoided. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and many of his staff are quarantining themselves for 2 weeks after another staff member tested positive for the virus. In Britain, where Prime Minister Boris Johnson and Prince Charles are among 22,000 confirmed COVID-19 cases, the government's deputy chief medical officer says the lockdown there could last as long as 6 months, but could be eased if people do as they're told and conditions improve. Lockdowns are also being extended in Nepal, Slovenia, and Argentina. Last week, Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi ordered the country's 1.3 billion people to remain indoors until April 15th, saying that was the only hope to stop the epidemic. But the order has left millions of impoverished Indians jobless and hungry. For more on the impact of the order on India's vulnerable, I spoke with Meenakshi Ganguly, the South Asia Director for Human Rights Watch, via WhatsApp.
You know, first of all, it has to be said that really with 1.3 billion people, the challenge for any government is going to be enormous. And, you know, the Indian authorities are trying as far as possible to keep the numbers in check. This is still at a containment stage, as they call it, because if it spreads in a country as densely populated as India, where people live in very closed clusters and close-knit communities, the outcomes can be disastrous. But with that in mind, when the government did order the lockdown, we're not quite sure why it had to be such a sudden thing, why there was not enough warning, why the state did not make enough preparations to ensure that supply lines were protected, that people were protected. Unfortunately, it was done within hours. He announced it at around 8 o'clock, and by 12 o'clock, everything was shut. People were scrambling to get supplies. And that really has been the challenge. It is, for now, what is happening is that people with young children are wondering where to get food, people with you know, older people haven't got enough supplies, particularly because the government had said, please do not hoard, which was the right message. But to ensure against hoarding, they had to keep the supply lines open. And that, unfortunately, in many places has not really worked. They're trying to fix it now. They've ordered the supply trucks to now open and deliver supplies. So hopefully things will get better. So that's one side of it. The other side of it, which has been much more challenging, is the huge numbers of migrant workers that started to go back home. And no one had anticipated it. And this crush of humankind that is trying to move from the cities to rural areas has been an enormous challenge.
What has been the impact of that? Because, I mean, we're talking about scores and scores of people here. How is this truly affecting them and making sure that they are protected at the basic human levels?
Well, you know, this is where the lack of planning, the lack of foresight has been a problem. Because when the Prime Minister announced this, he said, everybody, please remain where you are. Now, for people to remain where they are, they need jobs. These are people that have to work to get their next meal. If they have their supplies, how would they have eaten? And plus the panic over the fact that there was imminent disease that was going to strike through populations meant that people wanted to go back to their loved ones. So in all of this, there had to be better preparation, which unfortunately just did not happen.
You bring up that there could have been or should have been better preparation. How is the government retroactively addressing that?
Well, for now, what has happened is that in the initial times, there was a tendency to try and force the issue, as in if because there's no public transport, the expectation was that people would just stay where they were. But what they had not anticipated is people are going to start walking back home. And that's what happened. So we found scores upon scores of people just walking through the highways, trying to walk back like hundreds of miles back to their villages. So there has been now some attempt to try and have buses. But this is the problem. If the idea behind this whole lockdown is that the disease, if there's an infection, if the virus is in urban areas, it doesn't spread to countryside where the health services are really, really skeletal, then this is not the best way to do it. So now they will have to, what the government will now need to do is before people enter into their villages, there needs to be some sort of testing.
That was South Asia Director for Human Rights Watch, Meenakshi Ganguly. Confirmed cases of COVID-19 continue to increase in the Pacific. French Polynesia has recorded 35 known infections, while cases continue to rise in the U.S. territory of Guam. Other island nations are doing all that they can to keep the virus out, while New Zealand has recorded its first death from COVID-19. Phil Mercer has more.
Officials in the U.S. territory of Guam are warning the number of coronavirus cases are likely to surge. Over the weekend, President Donald Trump declared a major disaster in Guam and ordered emergency federal assistance. There are fears health services in the Pacific won't be able to cope with large numbers of infections. A week-long lockdown has begun in Tonga as the authorities try to keep the archipelago free of COVID-19. In French Polynesia, a nighttime curfew will be enforced until April 15 to try to contain the virus. There's a state of emergency in Samoa. Its efforts to keep the virus away from its shores have been boosted by a grant of $5 million from the World Bank. In Papua New Guinea, systems that helped to control an outbreak of polio last year have been reactivated to deal with the threat of COVID-19. New Zealand has recorded its first coronavirus death as the number of known coronavirus infections increases. A full lockdown has been imposed across the country in an effort to slow the spread of the highly infectious disease. All foreigners have been banned. Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern told Radio New Zealand the emergency will last a long time.
We will be having to manage COVID-19 for months until, of course, there's a vaccine, and that will be many months. My goal, though, is to, at the end of this 4 week, at least be in a position where we have the ability, at least for some parts of the country, to move to a lower level of our alert system. That's my focus for now. In the longer term, we're having to think about the borders.
Australia is forcing all citizens returning to the country into mandatory and monitored 14-day quarantine in hotel rooms paid for by the government. Travellers returning from overseas have so far made up two-thirds of Australia's COVID-19 cases. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
As the coronavirus outbreak is overwhelming health systems around the globe, scientists are expediting their research to come up with effective medications and vaccines to combat the pandemic. VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawy asked Dr. Talal Nsouly, clinical professor of immunology and allergy at Georgetown University and a research scientist at its International Center for Immunology Studies, about the latest developments. With the global COVID-19 death toll continuing to rise, accelerated efforts to develop coronavirus treatments are primarily focused on adapting existing drugs used to fight other diseases.
There are other trials coming out. There is another medication called Remdesivir. Remdesivir is an antiviral agent that appears to be very effective. It was used against the Ebola, but failed with Ebola, but appears to be effective in vitro in the lab against the coronavirus 19. And there is another treatment also as well that is an anti-IL-6 medication, tocilizumab, monoclonal antibodies that will attack the chemical, the inflammatory chemical that's released in the body. We have a explosion of chemicals in our body when we get infected with the coronavirus, but because the coronavirus stimulates a severe inflammatory response, and when we have an activation of inflammatory response, we have chemicals that come out of our cells called cytokines, and we call it a cytokine storm because the storm is producing millions of molecules of cytokines, and these cytokines unfortunately do not only attack the virus, but also attacks us and kill us as well. So now these studies are underway. There's also another treatment, which is transferring the antibodies. So let's say if someone gets an infection with the coronavirus, this person will produce antibodies against the coronavirus. And these antibodies, unfortunately, it takes a while to produce them because we don't have any immunity against the coronavirus. So it takes a while for a normal person to produce antibodies, which are proteins that have a tendency to kill the coronavirus. But it takes a while, and that's why, while waiting for the immune system to respond, the virus is killing people or handicapping people or causing major damage. But people that survive the coronavirus, if we check in their blood, in their plasma, they have IgG anti-coronavirus 19. Since they are doing well and the coronavirus disappears from their blood, they are healthy. We call it a convalescence type of serum. We can take their serum that contains these antibodies and we inject them in the patient who is very sick, that has a lot of viruses. The viral load is very high and they are very sick. By injecting this in these patients, will give a, it's called a passive immunity. And this passive immunity that was transferred from one patient to another will immediately allow the patient to fight the viruses that are in this patient with the antibodies that came from another individual that was infected in the past and produce these proteins that are known to attack the virus. So these things are done. And now also there are studies on the vaccine against the coronavirus. They're accelerating it. And Mr. Trump is extremely aggressive for that. He gave a lot of financial support, and also he really stimulated the National Institute of Health to accelerate all the studies for the vaccine against the coronavirus. But let me tell you, to all our people that are listening to us or reading what you are saying, that the vaccine for the coronavirus is going to take at least 10 months or 1 year or 1.5 years to come out, if you are lucky. Contrary to what we read on the social media, I just opened social media this morning. Okay, a vaccine is ready to come out, and this vaccine, it takes 3 weeks. After 3 weeks, you can use it, all of us. Completely wrong. This was a thing on Facebook or was on one of the places. So we have to be careful. A lot of information is wrong, or blogs that are written as well by a group of people that are not physicians are totally wrong. So please, one has to really read the appropriate information. Where do we read? We listen to the right news and not fake news. And to look at the CDC.org and to look at the WHO.org.
That was Georgetown University's Dr. Talal Unsouly speaking to VOA senior analyst Mohammed Elshenawy. And coming up later...
So the first thing I tell people is schedule your day in its entirety.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. Friday, U.S. President Donald Trump signed an executive order authorizing the Defense Department to order units and members of the National Guard and Reserves back to active duty in efforts to combat the spread of the coronavirus. To learn more about this development and what roles they may play in the U.S. response, I spoke with VOA Pentagon correspondent Carla Babb via Microsoft Teams.
So the National Guard has been working on this coronavirus response for several days now. They've got about 15,000 currently working all across the nation. They're doing things from, you know, testing different patients. For example, they will go into some of these drive-through areas and test the patients. They will suit up. They will check patients for symptoms to see if they need to be tested. And they're doing the small stuff, too, the small but important stuff, like they are going in and disinfecting areas for people. They are taking meals out to the elderly for people. So a lot of things going on with the National Guard. What the president has done over the weekend is he has invoked the option of bringing out the individual ready reserves. So the individual ready reserves, it's kind of complex if you're not in the United States. Actually, it's complex even if you're in the United States. Most people who are not military do not know about this. But basically, when service members sign enlisted contracts, they actually have longer times than they serve. And so they have this option to go into the ready reserves, knowing that it's highly unlikely that they'll be called back into service. But if there is an emergency, they can be called back into service. If you are considered an officer, you're automatically put back into those ready reserves. So these people who have been out of active duty are now being called back in potentially. And I know that the Army and the Navy and the Air Force and the Marines have reached out for volunteers. The Army has already said that it's got over 14,000 volunteers that said, yes, they're willing to come back in. But especially people with medical specialties, they're going to be needed in this time's need. They are checking with the governors now to make sure that they're not taking people out of critical areas already to bring them up for the military. But if they aren't doing things critical already, they're looking to bring them back in to help with this response.
Now, we also saw that the U.S. Navy has two hospital ships that are treating patients both on the East Coast and the West Coast. What can you tell us as far as their roles as they are currently deployed?
So the Mercy that is in LA now is currently taking in patients. I know that the Comfort has arrived in New York and will start taking in patients as early as tomorrow. These are being utilized not for coronavirus patients, but for non-coronavirus patients, because these ships, they're not built for infectious diseases. So they're built for humanitarian aid and war casualties, basically. They're not set up to help with viruses. So they will be taking in patients from hospitals. The hospitals are going to drive them right up to the harbors and drop them off, and then they will be treated there. So the hospital beds and the medical professionals that are in these hospitals can start ramping up their efforts even more for the expected increase in coronavirus patients over the next couple of days.
Carla Babb is VOA's Pentagon correspondent. The Chinese city of Wuhan, where the coronavirus outbreak first emerged, began lifting a two-month lockdown on Saturday by restarting some metro services and reopening borders, allowing some semblance of normality to return and families to reunite. Reuters' Emer McCarthy has that story.
Cars and cyclists filled the roads of Wuhan on Saturday as a two-month lockdown in the city where the coronavirus first emerged began to be eased. The reopening of the city, which saw itself cut off from the rest of the country, marks a key turning point in China's fight against the virus. With high-speed trains allowed back into the city, passengers packed Wuhan station. This student says he's very happy to see his family. After being separated in Shanghai for 3 months.
Wuhan accounts for about 60% of China's coronavirus cases, but they have fallen sharply in recent weeks, a sign that the strict measures appear to be working. But even with the declining cases, authorities were taking few chances. Staff in masks and protective gear bustled around the railway station, giving out hand disinfectant and putting up signs reminding travellers they need a mobile phone-based health code to take public transport. And no one will be allowed to leave the city until April 8.
Emer McCarthy reports for Reuters News. Now, the coronavirus outbreak has forced millions around the globe to telework, which is another way of saying that they're working from home or remotely. Earlier, I spoke with Dominic Mizzarandino, who's the CEO of Inquisitor Media, to get a better idea of how to approach this new work environment, which is strange for so many.
In 1995, I started working online. And one of the first lessons I discovered was that you need to schedule your life in whatever that is. Every phone call I have is scheduled. Even every break I try to schedule, because you're not having the regiment of that commute to the office and that coffee break at 10 a.m. and the lunch break at 1 and the coffee break at 3 and the cigarette break. Your coworkers in the office, well, who were going to the office, you were used to that pattern. That pattern's now gone, so you have to recreate it. So the first thing I tell people is schedule your day in its entirety.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah, I never really thought about that. I mean, I've been working remotely for a number of years, almost a decade. But there are so many colleagues that I have spoken to that they just weren't prepared for it. It was not something that they had the tools for. And we always talk about steep learning curves with new technologies and stuff. Well, remote working also has a steep learning curve, not so much in just, you know, figuring out how you're going to plan your day, but how you're going to do your work.
Yeah. And one of the things, especially with the employees I managed over the years, and it's been literally hundreds, the biggest focus is you're managing them on the work they produce. And I think people who are starting to work remote aren't going to be used to that. They need to understand that the people they work with are still going to look for a certain result. How many Google Docs did you produce? How many radio programs did you produce? And in my case, how many stories did you write or edit? Or what did we do on the ads or whatever it is for the online business, Inquisitor? So when you're working remote, you have to be very conscious of the fact that your productivity is further scrutinized, because that's all they have to judge you by.
Now, there's also been a lot of discussion as to how productive individuals can be at work. There's always been the stigma against letting people go home and telework, because there's this image of people just goofing off at home. But some studies have actually shown that when you have fewer distractions from the office environment, your productivity goes up.
I do 100% agree. It's a personality type. Once you get in the groove of working remote, I find the productivity can increase. I, for example, before Corona, I never had a commuting time. I didn't have certain distractions. But yes, in managing people, I do find some personalities have to learn to make that adjustment. But if you do and you schedule yourself, like I said, think about the work you're creating, and you're already going to be in a better place, because you're more conscious, did I produce this and this result? And then over time, you start to say to yourself, I produced this result last week. What can I do this week?
And when you're in the office, there's interactions. You can get immediate feedback. But, you know, working at home, you know, you can sometimes go an entire day without hearing a peep.
Yeah, I think you need to create that. And I'm a very big advocate of it, in the sense that I am almost overly communicating. At times, you have to really create that new relationship so people don't say, oh, you've asked me that, you know, checked in on me 5 times today, and I expect you to check on me twice. But I will overly communicate. I start every day, for example, with a phone call with my director of operations, Effie, every morning, 8:30. In addition, you'll add in things like I frequently will do video calls, and I will frequently add in, let's have coffee today, especially in coronavirus with the psychological component to it. I will add in things like having coffee with coworkers where we will literally video, so you get that human interaction.
Dominic Mizzarandino is the CEO of Inquisitor Media. And with that, that'll do it for us today. You've been listening to International Edition. on The Voice of America. On behalf of our entire production staff, thank you very much for listening. And until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Have a great day.